All right. Well, I first of all want to thank everyone for joining us for David versus Goliath, which is an e-discovery program we put together here. And everyone knows the story of David versus Goliath, where David of the Israelites killed a 9-foot giant from the Philistines named Goliath. He outsmarted the giant by using a slingshot to shoot a stone through the gap in the giant's armor. In the real world, David's and Goliath's face off all the time. Perception is that David is usually at a huge disadvantage, which is why the story of David versus Goliath is such a classic. Just ask Rocky Mediate. So today, we're going to look at what happens when small companies or individuals take on large companies in litigation where electronic discovery is at issue. Does having lots of resources and access to top law firms give David or give Goliath an unfair advantage in these cases? Do Davids have an advantage by not having as many records to review, thereby putting most of the pain of electronic discovery on the Goliath? Do Davids have the sophistication to play in the electronic discovery field? In fact, this topic became a presentation based on a comment a preeminent judge in the electronic discovery world made that he was concerned that certain bars were doing a disservice to their clients by not learning electronic discovery, which would put their clients at a disadvantage when suing large companies. Before we start, I'd like to introduce our panel. They are each experts in their own right, and their biographies and mine are included in your materials. In fact, seriously, I wish they weren't experts. This could be a lot more fun if we could talk about unsophisticated mistakes that parties can make instead of what these seasoned lawyers would do. But I can't get any incompetent people on my panels, and I haven't figured out how to extend such an invitation to an incompetent panel. So with that in mind, here's the panel. From David's perspective, we have both Luke Santangelo and Tom French, who've represented David clients for many years against Goliaths like Starbucks, Land O'Lakes, and Vail Resorts. They're based in the Colorado area. That's a northeastern, you know, description of anything out in the West, Colorado area. I'm sure you're from a city. I just don't have it in front of me. But they're solo practitioners who collaborate. They can't get much smaller than that, so I'm not sure how tall they are. They might be bigger than Goliath physically. And I know Patrick, Maria, Kevin, Ron aren't incredibly tall, but we aren't doing this thing with slingshots and swords. From Goliath's perspective, wearing lots of armor and standing about 6 feet tall from memory is Patrick Oot, who spearheads the electronic discovery effort at the national communications company Verizon. Patrick is also a well-known speaker on the e-discovery circuit, has a slew of articles written on him, and his process-oriented approach to electronic discovery. The next Goliath has been on a number of my shows and been in a number of the articles. He's also the million-dollar bill in the electronic discovery game Discovery Land, which I think has been included in the materials, or at least the board part. This is Kevin Esposito. Kevin's a total New Yorker with lots of great opinions about electronic discovery. When I think of Kevin and hear him speak, I think of the New York Yankees. He's also been covered all over the e-discovery world and as a technology lawyer at two Fortune 50 companies. He is now director of electronic discovery at the e-discovery consulting firm Metager. Maria Lona heads Winston Strawn's e-discovery group out of Chicago. She's the only Goliath. She's only a Goliath because her law firm's an AmLaw 100 firm, and she plays a very prominent role there in electronic discovery. However, I've heard she's a very nice person and good to work with. And since Marie's from Chicago, I'm not going to use the Chicago Cubs as an example of how Goliath can lose frequently. While I'm the program creator and will serve as moderator, the other moderator is the former magistrate judge Ron Hedges, who spent many years on the bench and has spoken at numerous conferences on the National E-Discovery Circuit. He's also, like many of the speakers, part of the Sedona Conference, and today he works of counsel at Nixon Peabody, an AmLaw 100 law firm. As a result, you could say Goliath will have another advantage, an impartial judge. However, I'm not here to tell you life's fair. I just want to explore this issue and how size impacts electronic discovery projects. Personally, I'm a legal entrepreneur who writes and talks about electronic discovery and records management. And after working for about 10 years in the field, I've moved into the virtual law firm field, which is further described in my bio. But since I don't consult professionally in the electronic discovery field, I have no biases or client issues to impact my views. I like to say I'm the NPR of electronic discovery. And that's perhaps one reason why we're able to present this first ever analysis on David versus Goliath in electronic discovery. I mean, it's sort of comforting for me to know that tomorrow Goliath's not going to call me to complain, regardless of what I might accidentally say on this really important, possibly sensitive issue. There are issues on both sides for David and Goliath, and these cases do happen. That's why last November I was talking to Judge Facciola, talking about this presentation. He said I should definitely set up a panel to explore this issue further. Now for a little bit of logistics. To help you follow along, I'm going to break a project down into several stages: planning stage, collection, preservation and processing, review, production, you know, things you do in front of the court, and final thoughts. For the first time of the six or seven or eight of these presentations we've done, I think we've included the questions we're planning to ask. This change in format might provide you some context on where we're going with the discussion and might make it easier to take notes, but please let us know if you've listened in the past events if this is an improvement. What we don't have is the answers to the questions, and that's up to the panel to provide. I don't want to pretend that I own the market on good or bad questions on this topic. I might skip around a little bit. If you have a question, please email it to me at kas@makinglaweasy.com. If you don't have access to email, you can always do this in the future, and I'll get it out to the panel. But as I joked before, better to do it live and hear the panelists squirm, I think. So let's get started. Hopefully you'll find this to be a religious experience to share for thousands of years, like the original David versus Goliath. I'm setting lofty goals for me in the panel. So let's start off in the planning stage. Marie, at what point do you start preserving records when you are Goliath and you get an inquiry from a David-like entity? I mean, is this a mosquito buzzing around me, or am I about to catch malaria?
Sure, I will start tackling that question. And unfortunately, there's no real bright line here. Of course, there's no bright line in any e-discovery issue. And it really depends on what is the inquiry that you received or your client received. Obviously, something very clear-cut as a complaint, yes, you get notice of a complaint, you get served with a complaint, you have to start preserving records and information. But when you get to a letter, what does the letter say? Who is it from? Is it very detailed with respect to the potential issue? Does it act in a conciliatory nature or not? Is it simply just saying, I'm about to sue you, preserve evidence? Depending on what that letter says, is what I would discuss with my clients to reach a conclusion as to whether or not they need to start preserving evidence. If it's not as formal as a letter, it's just somebody mentioned something or an employee has a reason to suspect that litigation might occur. Those are going to be slightly trickier issues, but again, it's going to depend on exactly if it's an employee, what the employee knows, why they suspect. Is that a type of litigation that the company faces all the time or not? If it's something that routinely happens to the company, probably might lead me to suggest they should start preserving evidence. If not, then look at the facts surrounding the issue and make a determination from there. But again, it's not just... It comes down to more than a mere possibility. Unfortunately, I think it is generally on a case-by-case basis. But ultimately, if working with my client, I think that there's a reasonable anticipation, then yes, I will instruct them to start preserving information.
Carl, may I add something to that?
Luke
Santangelo here.
Go ahead, Luke.
In our Cash Laputa Land O'Lakes situation, we wrote a letter 2 years before we filed the complaint. We wrote a letter to Land O'Lakes and informed them of the problem they had with respect to the trademark. We informed them what we thought was very explicitly that they needed to not use an infringing trademark, that it would expose them to willful damages, that it would expose them to personal liability, and that the damages for willful infringement were more, and that part of the purpose of the letter was basically, in case they chose to ignore us, that we would be setting them up for willful infringement. Said that way, from David's perspective, it would seem like that ought to be just fine. Now, we balance the risk of getting a declaratory judgment action in an unfavorable venue, and so we ended the letter with, "But we're willing to listen if you have anything to talk about." That was fatal from Magistrate Schaefer's perspective, that was fatal to their obligation to preserve evidence back in 2002. In his decision, he basically said, well, you said you were willing to talk, so they didn't know there was a reasonable anticipation of litigation, and therefore they didn't have to preserve at that point in time, never enclosing the letter on the decision. And I think it's, to me as a David, it's pretty darn surprising, because whether you know it or not, all of us Davids worry about getting decked in a wrong jurisdiction, because that runs the cost.
But if I can interject, and this is Ron Hedges, what the Land O'Lakes decision shows is just how fact-intensive this entire question is and how important it is to create whatever type of a record you can if you're going to go into a court at some point and argue that the preservation obligation attached at a certain time.
Yeah, I was at a conference in D.C., and Judge Shindlin was going through an update on cases, and she mentioned that case, Luke, and she gave it out as sort of a warning that you got to even be more specific. But she looked a little incredulous based on the letter. So, Tom, how do you approach an electronic case at the beginning as David?
Well, I don't approach it as business as usual or the same old, or the old boy way. I think a key to success is to have a David philosophy, which is none of those things. It's not business as usual. The David philosophy, I think, is part Brer Rabbit, part Che Guevara, part Wee Willie Keeler. It's kind of a mixing metaphors and examples, but Wee Willie Keeler is a baseball player from a long time ago who said you need to hit them where they ain't. I think you need to strike where you're not expected. I think you need to do what your opponent is afraid you will do. You need to proceed with lasers and not with scorched earth. I think you need to turn strengths against your opponent. And all that may be very different than the way that you usually conduct discovery. I think you also have to remember that it really is like a guerrilla war. And like any guerrilla war, it won't be easy or cheap or quick. And maybe most important, you better be a true believer in your case and your facts, or you better not bring it, because you're going to be fighting this fight for a long time, and it's going to be a hard fight, and there's going to be lots of doubters out there, including the other side and most likely the judge, if you don't have experience before this judge, because let's face it, Davids don't have credibility. And the biblical David earned his very quickly, but if you're not a biblical David, you have to earn your credibility slowly, kind of one small victory at a time, so it's going to be a long fight. So you better have this. It's going to be a long fight, and it's going to be different, and some of the things I usually do kind of may not work in the David versus Goliath case.
Tom, you earn extra points for referencing the biblical story in your answer. Luke, do you enjoy being David, or would you like to be Goliath sometimes?
Well, there's no doubt in my mind I like being David. I think Goliath has some advantages. I wouldn't mind a client that can afford to pay me all sorts of money to do all sorts of things. But when you look at e-discovery, heavens, I think Goliath's at a big disadvantage. You mentioned it earlier, Carl, and I think you're exactly correct. They have collections of documents that can be huge, and as Marie wrestles with whether to preserve things and what to collect, I mean, she's got a formidable task in front of her. David, it can be very easy. Our case was very easy because we had every document in our office, in 60 boxes, every document, every electronic document. That was pretty easy because there were none. So it was pretty easy on the David side. I think Goliath, that's a formidable task, and I think they've got a bit of work because they have to go through and preserve and protect and do those kinds of things.
I think I heard Patrick hit the ground there. Just, are you okay, Patrick, 50 boxes?
It was 60. It was 60.
Okay.
It would be a dreamy case.
Ron, generally speaking, what are the most egregious issues you would see from the bench from an unprepared party in electronic discovery, and did size ever play into this?
I think you can begin with the 26F meeting, that attorneys are supposed to be having before they come to a judge with a discovery plan. And I can't tell you whether this is a David or Goliath issue or really a law firm issue. If the firm is used to being in federal court and they're used to going through the 26F process, then I think everything can move along slowly. But one of the problems with who we'll call the Davids, one way or the other, may be relatively small firms that, as a general proposition, do not engage in federal practice on a regular basis. So I can see situations, and I have seen situations, where because of that dichotomy between the experience of the law firms, there are problems putting a real 26F plan together. And that certainly is an issue. Also, issues that come up often, and I can't tell you again whether this is a David and Goliath issue or just the nature of the litigant issue of the attorneys, is that you may see sweeping discovery requests made by one party, and it is kind of one-sided in the sense that the responding party has a lot more information than another one does. So that's another problem that comes up, that a judge would have to address those issues, the scope of discovery and the like.
Luke, David used a slingshot to kill Goliath. Since tools are important in e-discovery, how does David go about picking technology to manage electronic records? Do you Google them? You know, picture the red sea of e-discovery vendors to choose from, or is the tool a red herring for David which can distract you?
Well, I don't think the tool is a red herring. I think you have to have tools because you're going to get hit with a collection of electronic things, and you have to deal with them in some fashion. I don't think you can just go through and collect this stuff and not do anything with it. You have to do something. And so I think there are a number of tools out there. We happen to have ultimately settled on a software package called Summation, which worked quite well for us. We were able to take the produced electronic discovery, have it, look at it, yes, look at metadata, look at everything, turn it into OCR form, make it word searchable, and just deal with it. So I think the tools are very important because you're going to need to deal with it. But they're available. I don't think they're that hard. Google it. We asked around and looked at packages others had used and eventually talked to the vendors and selected Summation, which worked quite well for us.
Hey, Ron, one of the reasons that electronic discovery continues to be so messy is it's a multidisciplinary field involving law, technology, people skills, project management. How can a solo practitioner really hope to do this well when the biggest companies trip over themselves? I mean, do you have to cut them some slack in a case as a result?
On the one hand, if you're in a true David situation, as was mentioned before, there may not be that much electronically stored information that the David has. So that certainly might make things go a little easier for the David. And in addition to that, there are tools that might be available to assist him or her in collecting information or in reviewing information. And given the variety of technology out there today, I don't know that I could say that the David is at some type of disadvantage generally. But as far as cutting someone slack, I think this goes back to the importance of a Rule 26F conference and the presentation made to the judge at the initial Rule 16B scheduling order. And that's very important that an attorney needs to explain to a judge what his or her restrictions are to try to have those taken into account in a scheduling order. Now, will a judge cut someone a slack? I don't know if I would call it cutting slack, but I think you could reasonably say that if an attorney makes a presentation and the judge understands what his or her constraints are, that should be reflected in a scheduling order. And that's where you want to have it reflected. You don't want to have to deal with any problems when you're on the receiving end of some type of application to compel production of ESI or the like because you agreed to produce it or served on a certain date and you didn't work out some type of reasonable extension that was needed.
Okay, Kevin, since you're a techie lawyer, do you have any advice for Davids on how to pick the right vendor? I know that we've covered this in detail for large companies in past presentations, but bear in mind, many small firms, this will be the first time they've ever done this before without any experience, and everyone wants both sides to be doing this efficiently.
Well, a couple of things you need to remember are, first of all, you need to do your research. It never ceases to amaze me that people will go out on the Internet and they'll research mortgage prices and the price of a new car and get all kinds of facts and figures, and yet when they get approached on anything related to electronic discovery, they'll just grab the first name or the first ad that they happen to see somewhere. You need to do a lot of research as to fact-specific information. One size does not fit all in this industry. So there are some really terrific tools that, if used, might give you lots of bells and whistles, but it will also break your budget. On the other hand, there are some relatively smaller tools and smaller vendors, and they might fit into your timelines and your budget just as well. In general, the smaller you are, the larger your advisor should be. Forrester Research points out that there's over 400 different vendors in this space that provide either tools, platforms, consulting, or whatever have you. There's no way that any one person could know everything about all 400 groups. So if you have a partner that has a little bit more breadth, someone who perhaps participates in industry organizations such as EDRM or Sedona, if there's somebody out there that you can reach out to that has a feel for many different items, you're not going to get stuck with a tool or a vendor that is going to leave you high and dry. You'll probably be able to get at least 2, 3, 4 different alternatives, and then it's up to you as the solo practitioner to decide which of these really fits my particular situation. Another item to point out is make sure that whoever you hire can speak to you in plain English. This is something a lot of us went through in law school, where we took courses in plain English for lawyers and things of that nature. It's the same thing on the IT or the consulting side. If someone comes in and tries to explain to you that you need to go down a particular path and gives you all kinds of gobbledygook, your radar should go off. Any organization coming in should be able to explain to you why the particular path that they're suggesting fits the specific facts of your case, the timeline that you have, and the budget that you have at your disposal. If you can't understand what they're telling you, they're probably the wrong person to go with.
This is Patrick. I'd like to add one thing with that, too, is I would definitely ask for a proof of concept. You know, one thing that we've engaged upon is, you know, insourcing a lot of our technology. And there are a lot of people out there promising a lot of things, and oftentimes what I've found is those promises aren't necessarily things that they can keep. So definitely do a test on one of your smaller cases, one of your smaller matters, using your own data on their systems before you go ahead and engage them.
Kevin, Luke here, if I may add something. What we found was their support capability was also very important, because at times we even had the company write us little macros and plugins that would help us import certain data and whatnot. So they really customized things to achieve what we needed to do, and I think that support is a pretty important thing. Certainly, you're going to need to buy the support package and have them available throughout the process.
You know, this question's not on the outline, but sort of a follow-up to what we're talking about. It seems to me, from my experience, this is really a multidisciplinary challenge, and is it even realistic to expect to find that one consultant that can wrap this all up in a box, put a bow on it, and say this is your e-discovery solution, even if you're a small party? Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
Well, this is Kevin again. I think that it really depends upon the facts of your case. There are multiple instances that I know of where people were able to single source. So there is the ability to work with one vendor or one organization to get your needs met. The more complex the case, however, the more complex your approach has got to be, and that's where you really need to get additional information out to people in order to try to perhaps send out some feelers and say who's ever dealt with an energy-related case or who's dealt with an insurance-related case, trying to get information from local people as to what they may or may have seen out there, because that's where you probably are being forced into additional vendors or additional tools, but it doesn't mean that you can't go out there and find something.
Marie, is this concern about managing an electronic discovery project even David's concern? I mean, they're on the receiving end of a project. They're receiving gigabytes, terabytes, even more information dumped on them, okay, on the receiving end. But isn't the pain at this stage really aimed at Goliaths who have to preserve, review, then produce all this information?
Well, clearly, from the Goliath standpoint, there is a lot of pain on this, because we are, as we've already discussed, we hold more volumes of information than we possibly can understand at times. And it's in disparate locations, possibly throughout the world. So clearly we're suffering from a lot of pain in this, and choosing the right vendor or service provider or third party to help you, whether that's possibly one person or a multitude of people, is critically important. I do think, though, as has already been discussed by Kevin and Luke and everybody, that yeah, it is important, though, for the smaller people as well, because ultimately once I get through my pain and determine how I'm going to produce and what I'm going to produce and then actually turn it over to a small individual or a solo practitioner or a very small law firm, they need to go through it. And you only can do that with the volumes of information that we're often talking about if you have some ability to manage what you're receiving and understand how you can best go through it in the time frames that we're all faced with.
I think there's, Luke here again, I think there's an advantage again for David, because you're going to get this collection of information, and don't, the Davids out there, don't assume that the Goliaths really know what they've given you. I don't think they really do, and that's almost another advantage to being a David, because you're going to find stuff that they may not even know about. Sure, it takes diligence, but I know in our situation, I think we were the masters of the documents, not them, and they produced them.
Let me take a shot at David then. I'm sorry.
Well, this is Ron again.
Go ahead, Ron.
And I was going to suggest that that's a very appropriate observation to make in a program like this, that it's not necessarily the person with the greatest amount of data who is in the best situation, either reviewing it or in producing it. And I suppose later on we can talk about the Stanley opinion that just came out recently. But it just talks and puts you on notice that you need to be very clear with what you're doing and what assistance you have. And this goes along the lines of what Kevin just said about making choices who you're going to have assisting you in the course of the litigation.
Yeah, the point I was going to throw out there is I've been involved in some mass tort type cases where I was sort of in, you know, on the people side, but I was also surprised to see cases going to trial while productions are still occurring. So, you know, it's somewhat on the David side. Are the Davids looking at everything they're getting? You know, just curious. And we're getting music in the background.
Somebody, I don't know where it's coming from.
That's a Philistine battle hymn, I think. I'm mistaken. I was Googling this last night, and
well,
anyway.
I think the Davids, Luke here again, I think the Davids need to go through everything, and that's one of the nice advantages that you have, is when you do have things available to you, you can find things and use them more appropriately. Goliath may not even know what's going to show up. I know in many instances we were in hearings where we're talking about documents that they had no clue about.
Okay. Hey, what? I'm going to ask you a question, Patrick, and feel free to talk on, because I've got a 703 phone number call. I'm wondering if we have even any listeners here. But I'm going to check into that. Patrick, this may be a warm-up question. You may do it again in a second. But how do you deal with identifying all your relevant records when you're Goliath? I mean, you're a process expert. Are there any ways to reduce scope when the other side might have little incentive to agree to reduce scope?
Well, you have to remember that, you know, this is still discovery, and everything starts with an investigation and the litigation hold on the key players found in the investigation. Again, oftentimes large organizations need to spend time understanding the story of what happened, what the dispute is about, who is involved. In many cases, large organizations limit a scope to the key employees identified in the investigations, and if our adversary requests a good faith addition to the scope of the custodians, we often do that for them. In some, you know, if an adversary blows up any limitation on the scope of the discovery, that adversary will be forced to deal with the same dilution of data after production. As we insource more and more of our technology to deal with the large data volumes at cost, limitations will help our opponent more than it will actually assist us. So I'm thinking that there's more of an incentive on both sides of the V to be precise and to be efficient. The bench is less tolerant of discovery gamesmanship, and I feel that you'll see more and more collaboration in the cases to come.
Well, certainly that's the model that the federal rules encourages and the 26F amendments in December 2006. I expect you are going to see judges be much more concerned about parties having meaningful discussions among themselves and cooperating when they can. And certainly there are areas where you're going to be in a dispute with the other side that you can't reconcile among yourselves. But I would certainly suggest from past experience, from what I know now, that judges expect parties to make sincere efforts to try to resolve things. And this is a perfect area to try to resolve things, just because what the nature of the dispute may be, and also the time and effort that might be necessary to resolve everything.
Let me. This is Tom, and Ron. I appreciate that, but quite frankly, as a David, what I'm used to hearing is, we have all these documents, and we can't possibly produce them. It's going to cost way too much, and then, and I just don't believe it because my experience has borne out that the cost is not as much as they say, and there aren't, and the difficulty is not as much. Claims that will take 8 hours to produce, you know, backup tapes, and then we find out it will really take 30 minutes, things like that. So the truth is, at the scheduling conference, I'm not real inclined at that point to be real believing when I hear a lot of the claims about the difficulties of the e-discovery. Call me a cynic, but that's my experience.
Well, at least at that point you can have identified where you think the issues are going to be. Tell the judge what those issues are early on, so the judge has an opportunity to resolve them before you go down the litigation path.
Yeah, this we can continue this discussion, and I'll add Kevin into this, and Tom and Ron. But a theme you do hear at the large national e-discovery conferences is these meet and confers, and at the beginning both sides really should be playing fair with each other at the starting point, try to get focus on the litigation. And it is something everyone says, you hear it over and over again. And back when I was thinking about this program, I mentioned, what about when it's a big guy against a little guy, and everyone laughed in the audience. I'm telling you, it was funny. So I think I'm picking up on the David's theme on this. Does this theme really disappear completely when a big party is squaring off against a smaller party? And, I think we've already heard David's perspective on this. Ron, maybe it's fair to ask you, as someone who's been sort of a judge looking at this.
I think that it often happens, as the closer you get to some type of a need to be in court, the more fine-tuned things become. So to the extent that you can't resolve this early on and you have to do some type of a process to get before a court, that in itself moves things along. And certainly, I really have to say that just because you are a David in the litigation doesn't mean you are at some disadvantage internally as a lawyer as opposed to the other side. I think for the reasons we indicated earlier, it may well be that that David is in a better situation than the Goliath is. So, again, it's hard to give you some general proposition in this area one way or the other, but I would suggest that you need to keep attempting to resolve things, even if you're skeptical of it. And it's frankly, it would seem to me, it's in the best interest of a David to try to resolve it as quickly as he or she can, to demonstrate to court that you're acting in good faith to try to resolve a dispute.
This is Tom again. Except that my goal is to get all the documents that there are out there that are good for my client. And when I don't know what they are or what the information infrastructure is, you know, if I'm giving anything up at the front end, I'm scared to death that I'm not going to get all the documents that there are.
I don't know that it's a question of giving things up as opposed to knowing exactly what you want or knowing where to look for what you want and finding that out. So maybe that has to be the theme.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, it's Marie, and I guess speaking as a Goliath, and I certainly understand the reservations associated with believing what I necessarily come in and say in a 26F conference. And not everybody believes what I'm about to say, but earlier on we were talking about setting credibility with the court, with the judge. et cetera. And it's equally important for me, because if I don't walk into a 26F conference knowing all those questions and knowing how long, truthfully, being able to prove how long it would take me to find information off a backup tape or whatever it is, you know, I'm losing credibility not only with the Toms and Lukes and the Davids of the world, but I, more importantly, in my opinion, I'm losing credibility with the court. And so I do think, as a Goliath, I need to go in there understanding really what all of this is, so that if I do have to get in front of a court, I know what I'm talking about. I'm giving the proof to support my position. Hopefully I win, but it's all about credibility, and I'm not going to go in there risking and, you know, making numbers up to sound worse than they are just because I'm trying to win a 26F conference. I'm trying to win the whole war, not just the battle.
Well, Marie, this is Luke talking. I think you're the exception rather than the rule from my perspective, because I see that the Goliaths do tend to oversell and create it as if it's this unusually difficult task when we know it's not. Going back to one of the comments that Ron made, I think it's difficult to go in as a David and say, hey, I know exactly what I want and exactly what I need. As Davids, we don't know. We don't know what's
I'm going to have Patrick weigh in on this, because I'm going to change your question a little, Patrick. Lucas just said this is easy. You know, is this easy, or doesn't cost as much as it should? I mean, you know, spill your pain or give your perspective on this process.
Well, I don't think it's easy by any means. You know, I think that because we're dealing with standards of reasonableness and good faith, you know, there are sort of different standards of reasonableness for different cases. I really think that you know, it does become cheaper. As a large organization, you bring more and more of that technology in-house and not using outside vendors to process your own data for you. I think that if you have a group such as we do, you know, those costs are sort of defrayed a little bit. I do think if you're a small organization, you are going to have a tremendous problem, because you know, you might be unprepared, and all of a sudden a huge case hits you, and you don't have the processes in place. Again, this is really about preparedness. I think both plaintiffs and defendants must have some sort of plan in place for both data production and intake from their opponent. Just as I was saying before, we developed a privilege litigation manual. I think having these processes ironed out in place, how you're collecting stuff, how you're producing stuff, how your you know, how your typical infrastructure looks, and the legal reasoning behind that in a document is very important to the people that are working the process, the DRM process. I think a litigant really doesn't need a Big Four certified litigation preparedness plan, but you know, I think one merely needs a set of engineers to defend the process and to find those employees to manage the process and those that have the relevant information. So I think if you have a glib understanding of how your infrastructure works and you know, your different business units and how they're arranged, you can conduct an investigation and quite quickly figure out who the relevant custodians are for a matter. The true cost of collecting and review a finite set of documents is, you know, similar to what it used to be. A lot of things have not changed, you know, but you just have to be efficient in your investigation. You really have to limit it to those people that would likely have the relevant information.
Okay, we're going to go into the next stage, collection and processing stage, and we're close to being on time here, so this is good. I'm going to mention something to each of the speakers. When you're not talking, if you could put your phone on mute, I guess there's some feedback occurring, so I just want to let everyone know that. But go back and forth on the mute. Try not to hang up. Kevin, this is a topic that I've heard Laura Zugelake speak about a number of times. About paying for backup tapes. She often complained about the expense of the sharing the backup tape reviews being really unfair to David when her adversary wasn't producing documents she believed she was entitled to. It was economic injustice, according to her. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, backup tapes are a really sensitive issue with me simply because they've been overblown, in my opinion, as far as being a really great source of information. Most of the time, the backup tapes are just used as an opportunity to point to problems in process or problems in the way that information is managed within an organization. Most organizations, especially if they are a Goliath, they should be able to provide you with all the information that you need out of their active systems. So if you go to the active system and you get people to give the information out of that system, you should be able to just get everything you need right there. I would only really talk about going to backup tapes if there's the potential for active destruction of information for whatever reason. Backup tapes are a very, very expensive thing to work with. They really are kind of the third rail of electronic discovery. You've got to bring them all back. You've got to restore them. And I think that if you've got a very good showing, if you're a David and you can show that Goliath is intentionally destroying information, and by the way, 70% of all jury pools believe that corporations are destroying information, so that goes back to the credibility issue that some people have already talked about. If you can make a showing that something is wrong and people are getting rid of information, then by all means, if backup tapes potentially can have some older records on there that help your case, you should go after it. But because of the size, the scope, and the complexity of getting that information back, you've got to be prepared for the fact that, you know, the organization is going to say, I shouldn't have to do this. This is absolutely burdensome. This is not reasonably accessible data, using all of the buzzwords that are currently, you know, in our lexicon. And the best that you can hope for at that point is to do some sampling and go in and say, well, I'd like to sample X number of tapes from this time period. And if you get a sampling order, it will depend upon the strength of your showing. If you can show that you've got printouts of lots of information and the organization is saying that there's nothing back there, then perhaps you'll get a judge to say, okay, you know, sample 5 tapes and let the producing party bear the cost. On the other hand, if you've got 1 or 2 pieces of paper and that's it, and you're saying, I want you to go to backup tapes, be prepared for the judge to say you've got to share in those costs.
Oh, Luke has to chime in on that one. I hope not all the Davids out there are listening to what Kevin's saying. Kevin, I respect where you're coming from, but not needed, overly burdensome. Come on. A big company may keep all this information, and I know individual witnesses with very relevant information are frequently given the opportunity to delete their emails and change things. Sometimes they're even the ones that are requested to assemble things. And I think there's a huge danger for the Davids if you start accepting the approach that Kevin is suggesting, namely that all these backup tapes, they're too hard to get at, et cetera, and therefore don't force me to do that third rail. In addition, be very, very cautious, Davids, of this sampling concept, because I think that is fraught with danger for the Davids, where we want to find the smoking guns that exist out there.
Well, I have to push back because, you know, the biggest issue that I had when I worked for both of the Fortune 50s that Carl mentioned earlier was I spent a good 60% of my time proving the existence of things unseen. We were constantly proving that the allegations made against the Goliaths that we were currently deleting information and shredding documents just didn't happen. And that's the kind of thing that, as a Goliath, I've got to come back and say, look, it is not worth it to me, going back to what we talked about earlier about what you're trying to get across to the court. I agree with Marie. It is not worth it to me in a case with a David to try in some way, shape, or form to games play the whole situation simply because he or she is a David, because that's going to hurt me in every other issue that I've got come up across a lot of different courts. So it's on the behalf of Goliath. It pays for the Goliath to get out there and try to give as much information as possible. My only point is Goliath should be able to provide information out of the active systems. If the Goliath provides all of the information and the information isn't there, that's obviously something for David to consider. And, you know, Bob's your uncle. You go whichever direction you feel that you need to in order to defend your client. But most of the information should be available in a readily accessible format, as opposed to going back to something that takes a lot of work in order to recreate.
One more comment for David's on that same issue. I think there is a bias. This is Luke here again. I think there's a bias against David's by the court system,
who judges are more inclined to accept the sophisticated, understanding people such as Kevin out there who really, they work e-discovery, they know all the right buzzwords, as he said, they know the things to say. And yet, I think with respect to the David, sometimes we are at a disadvantage because the court won't accept comments as readily as they might from larger firms. For instance, when you have evidence that, people implemented email destruction programs 1 month after they learned that there was a problem, and you're not offered the opportunity to go into backup tapes, don't be surprised. It's a bit of a battle for David.
Well, we're going to move into the next question, but it sounds like, Luke, you wouldn't buy a used car from Kevin? I'm trying to...
No. I respect Kevin, and I think... I do want to say this, that I think, of course, Kevin's going to represent his Goliath and all that, and he's going to do it competently, ethically, and he's going to do it with credibility, but he's only as good as the information that arises, and I think as David's, we need to be aware of what he's fed by his client and the biases that exist.
Carl, let me just jump in on that comment because it raises something that's very important. One thing to think about, I'll kind of switch camps for just
talking?
A second. I'm sorry, this is Kevin.
This is Kevin.
One of the things to keep in mind if you are a David is who it is that you're talking with in the earlier meet and confer discussions. One thing I have found now that I've gone outside of being an in-house counsel and being an outside consultant is that a lot of times you will find it's outside counsel who is zealously guarding their client, and those are the people who will give you information about, it's going to take me 9 years and $93 million in order to do what you're asking me to do. What I try to do is get them closer and closer to speaking to actual in-house counsel about, is this correct? Is this, you know, your outside counsel is telling me it's going to take $93 million. Are those numbers, you know, correct? Is that what you're going to hang your hat on? And what I find is the closer you get to the actual client, the more focused those numbers become. And they come out of the stratosphere, and sometimes they'll come down to something that's a bit more reasonable.
And these are excellent points, and I also want to comment that even though both sides are aggressively giving their point of view, everyone here is a very ethical and strong advocate for their side, and that's why they're on the panel. This has been excellent thus far. Luke, incomplete collections seem to be a risk of all large data collections. You've actually mentioned this just a few minutes ago, Does it seem even more unfair to you when it's a smaller party because smaller parties might have a harder time mustering resources to prove that Goliath did produce all the relevant records? And I guess we talked a bit about that earlier, but who goes through the emails on your side to try to find gaps in email communication threads which show emails are missing?
Well, I think this is a very interesting thing. Yes, it is very difficult for David to show that they didn't produce all the relevant records. I think it's a real challenge. I'd love to hear Magistrate Hedges' perspective, or I should say ex-Magistrate Hedges' perspective, on it, because what I think sometimes happens is that the only context in which to raise a failure to produce and assemble documents is in the context of a specific discovery request where you can point to things and show gaps. And sometimes you can't show gaps. And I think it's somewhat difficult to get to the point where you can say, look, they didn't do what they needed to do to meet their assemblage and preservation obligations, devoid of a context of a specific request. I will mention that in the Victor Stanley case, that recent case, and in the O'Keefe case, it almost was like they gave short shrift to that issue. It was moving into what their email, or rather their search strings were, and their Boolean operators or whatever it may have been. But in fact, just getting to that point is difficult for us Davids, especially with perspectives where you have a limited number of requests, and it's sort of you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. Make them too broad, and you're not going to get good enough answers. That was one of the challenges we faced in the reported decision on the Cass-Laputer case, or make them so narrow and you're hardly going to get anything, and yet you only have a few number of requests, and yet the court's going to pick on you because your discovery requests are overbroad gibberish, as we were informed.
Well, I don't know about whether anything was overbroad gibberish, but the problem that a judge always faces, at least in the initial stages, is a document request asking for X amount of electronically stored information and the like, and an adversary who's coming in making some type of an argument that this is too broad one way or the other. And that's really a balancing test, at least in the first instance, that a judge has to make as to what he or she is going to be allowing when you start. Now, I would suggest that we really have to look at discovery as an iterative process, if you would. And the first answer that's given to the court may not be the final one. And certainly there's an opportunity as you go along for the David to sit down with the Goliath and, for example, try to agree on search terms to be looked at if there's a search being made of Goliath's database and the like, as opposed to the information totally being conveyed to the David and the David having to do the search all by himself. It's obviously a tension here between the judge who wants to move a case along and move it towards resolution and the party who really does not have that much information and needs to learn it. And I think this is part of an education that judges have to be given often as to how discovery should work in this and as to how, if David is not comfortable saying, I have everything, seeing a way to move on to get more information. That may not answer your question. The only thing I can suggest to you is it's some process that takes a while to do, and you have to hopefully try to engage the judge and get the judge to understand exactly what is going on.
This is sort of a try at the same, a similar question, but to Tom. When you're organizing your records, be it looking through for missed email gaps, but just organizing this, I know there was discussion about having a software package, but how do you actually get through your records with less resources?
Well, you may be David, but that doesn't mean you can do it on the cheap. What we had to do in our most recent case was we had to hire an independent contractor who looked through all the records and who, you know, entered data on all the records, and we spent, you know, a lot of money doing that. So you're gonna have to get through them all. It's malpractice not to, I think. So you're gonna have to get through them all, and if you can't, you're gonna have to figure out how much you're gonna be able to spend on this case, and still, do the job you need to do to represent your client. You can't do it cheap. You're probably going to have to hire folks to help you if you have hundreds of thousands of pages to go through. It's kind of that easy for me.
Luke, one more David question here. Even smaller companies have turnover, which is one of the issues that frequently comes up in these cases. They often have HR departments. Sometimes better known as the CEO/president who does everything at your client. How do small companies go back in time to find potentially responsive ESI?
Well, it's a delightful question. I think I'm going to have to tell you, first, in our Land O'Lakes case, we didn't have that problem. It was pretty easy. The president, the CEO, was also the IT department, and there was no IT. So it was all right there. Now, take a little larger David, a David that has some collection of ESI, and how are you going to deal with it? I think you're going to have to go hire some outside help to organize some things, or you're just going to provide them under the position that says, look, this is the way we keep them in the ordinary course of business, and have at it.
Kevin, if you want to take a shot at this as an IT expert, put yourself in the shoes of the small company or in the shoes of a large company advising them on collecting information, okay? Say there's no server or email record, as Luke just mentioned. There's no email record retention or destruction protocol. Maybe there are a number of ASP providers storing records for Davids of the World. Do these present opportunities of more messes for a large company to enforce discovery? Is it even worth the effort to try to understand the adversary's messy or lack of IT infrastructure?
Well, I think it's always worth trying to understand your adversary's IT infrastructure, regardless of whether it's messy or whether it's a Fortune 50, you know, perfectly run machine. You need to understand where you're looking for information and where you're getting it and where you're not getting it. In terms of a smaller organization, if you're a large company, you really have to dial it back a bit, and the best way is to try to compare and contrast. You've mentioned a few things here. You know, is there a server or there isn't a server? Is their email in-house or are they hosting it elsewhere? Probably one of the messiest things you can get into is if they don't have any hosted solution. They didn't go to 123.com or somebody like that and got a server set up specifically for them. They're using just Hotmail or Yahoo Mail or something of that nature. Then it's going to become very difficult trying to go back to grab all of those records. That's the kind of thing you have to keep in mind. On the other hand, just because you don't have protocols and just because you don't have servers doesn't absolve you from your preservation responsibilities if you have a litigation. That's the kind of thing whereby you might not get the actual information, but perhaps in that situation, if you're a larger organization, showing that the organization can't provide that information, but they have obviously committed spoliation, will put you in a better position.
Tom, we talked a little bit about 30B6 technology experts are going to be deposed on your IT infrastructure. Again, is this the CEO or president you just alluded to? Do you want to have them deposed this early, or would you rather handle this in an interrogatory since records and systems aren't voluminous?
Yeah, well, my experience is it's just like Luke said. It's usually, you know, you don't have a separate CEO, president, IT guy. You got one guy who's doing all those things, and so you... you know, if the other side wants to depose them early, that's kind of what, you know, they get this one guy. In the cases that I've handled, this has really been a non-issue, and it's just because there wasn't much of, there weren't any folks around.
Okay.
Luke here, if I may add something. On the other side, I think for the Davids out there, it's real important to go in and get an IT representative of the Goliath so that you can understand what they need to do and perhaps what they haven't done if that turns out to be the case. I think it's very important that you go in and look at their IT structure and learn it, because without it, you can't really pose a request to the court that's going to give you relief if that's what you're entitled to.
Maureen, knowing how difficult it is for a large company to collect and preserve records, which is a position I've seen and believe, do you turn around and scrutinize closely how a smaller party conducts its obligations, or does that open up Pandora's box a little bit?
Well, I do look to see what I've gotten from the Davids in my case, but what goes around comes around. So I do that. Understanding where my weaknesses are and what my client is having problems with. And it's probably not even intentional problems, it's just that there are issues with certain areas in the electronic information. So I am going to, the Davids do still have to comply with the exact same discovery obligations that my client has as a Goliath. And oftentimes, you know, things can go wrong there too. I mean, their home computers weren't properly preserved, and there was some information that might have been lost or otherwise is not actively available. Records otherwise that they have, and et cetera. So it's not to say that they can't come across some of the same issues that I do, just on a smaller scale. But yeah, I'm definitely thinking about if in the way that I'm pushing back as far as how they've met their discovery obligations, because I have to make the assumption that the minute I ask for something or the minute I challenge away something was done, that's going to be directed right back at me.
Mm-hmm.
Luke here, if I may say something for Marie, I think you're exactly right. With some Davids, you have to be very careful that you're not going to educate them, because we will turn around and shoot it right back to you, because we'll go, oh, my gosh, never thought of that. Thanks very much. And it'll come right back. So I think you're exactly on track, Marie.
Well, this is Ron Hedges, and what everyone is saying I think is very true. My experience usually was that when one side is asking for something in a certain way, there turns out to be reciprocity often. And when you're bringing a dispute to the court, And it turns out that dispute mirrors some problem that the other side is facing or the like. I would expect courts will normally say, you know, the sauce is good for the goose as it is for the gander. And if one party wants something, that party should be expecting to provide the same type of information to the other side. So I think this is an area, again, where you need to try to work things out if you can. And if you're going to go to court, see what the dispute is and see what can be visited on you when you go and present something.